You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
Good evening and welcome to The Lyric Feature. 85 years ago, a combination of war and storm left 18 Dutch seamen shipwrecked off the coast of Donegal. On hearing of their plight, 8 brave lifeboatmen left Arranmore Island to effect their rescue. The events that followed are part of the folk memory of the island, and in 2020, Brian McLynn, who's one half of the folk duo Ye Vagabonds, talked to the islanders and has woven their story into a modern radio ballad. This is the Ballad of the Stalwick Rescue.
I'm glad to have a nice young man in here, Brian McLynn, and he wants to find a story about the Stalwick. I'll tell all that I know. And that's not a terrible lot, but I was there that morning that it all happened. I was over 9 years of age at the time. I'm 87 now, and I've never seen a morning like it in all my life. And I don't want to see it again either.
The crew did not talk about it. Why did they not speak about it?
Yeah, my father was very proud of it. They were, you know, they all getting the medals, but they never talked about it much.
He just said the boat went down. More than that, he didn't say.
He knew that the men that he could trust, fishermen, just like himself, and they were all just as good as himself.
In December 1940, a Dutch cargo ship, the Stalwick, was driven into rocks by a hurricane-force storm off the northwest coast of Ireland. Her lifeboat was swept away, some of her crew were lost, and the British Navy tried and failed to rescue the crew. The following day, 8 fishermen from Arranmore Island sailed out into the storm and performed one of the bravest lifeboat rescues in history. Inspired by the work of Ewan McCall, Peggy Seeger, and Charles Parker, and set into song by Jerry Early, John Gallagher, and myself, Brian McGlynn, this is a modern radio ballad. The Ballad of the Stalwick Rescue.
I remember it very well. I remember going up with my dad, you know, for a kid having gone to school. And my God, he says, I don't know where they're going to go with a day like this, he said. It's terrible. It's a suicide, he said.
Tonight of any night, said the coxswain of the crew. The chances of survival on a night like this are few.
Evening of the 6th and the morning of the 7th, the wind was recorded 94 miles an hour steady. That's hurricane force.
December 1940, round the coast of Donegal, came a great north wind that could have been the cruelest of them all.
Jack told him, the skipper told him, we have to go, we have to go, we have to make this rescue. And they got a call the night before that, that there was 14 men on a boat. And they went into the lifeboat and they were lost.
14 men were missing, 18 more in great distress. Jack Boyle at their future and his hands had come to rest.
There was 2 sets of brothers, and there was Neely Byrne and Phil Byrne, and there was Jack Boyle and Phil Boyle. Jack was the coxswain, and Phil was the second coxswain. And Neely Byrne was engineer, and his brother was bowman. And then Joe Rogers and Brian Gallagher and Tig Ward.
He knew a man who knew the sea, if any man should know.
O'Donnell, that's right, Paddy Gundy. He was the oldest man. And Paddy did a lot of fishing down in Mararoti, down in that area, you see. So Paddy had a very old head on him anyway, he was a good seaman as well.
Will you show the way without delay? O'Donnell said, I'll go.
My name is Mary Kelleher, and I'm Jack Boyle's daughter.
Did he ever talk about it at all?
No, I don't remember. I don't remember him ever. I don't, because they used to go away so often during the war. They would let off the a rocket.
Flares, or?
The flares, yeah. We'd be waking up, but we'd fall asleep again. Andrew would be the only one that would remember. I was thinking, you know, he would be the only one now that's alive that would remember.
Look out there from your leave Tory Island, as far that way as you could see convoys coming in from America, going to Liverpool, going all over. And we could hear them at night, the bangs of torpedoes or whatever it was. And then for months and months and months, you couldn't go down that bay with wreckage, timber, rubber, everything floating about. They used to be out every day collecting timber, logs, hatches. Most of all the houses here are all built with wreckage. Nobody knew where it was all coming from. But even at night, we were that much afraid that we were going to bed at night. All we had was a wee lamp, and you had to put out the lamp in case the planes overhead to see it. Because we were afraid that the Germans would bomb us.
Phil Byrne would have been the bowsman. That's where it started for me with him. I was asked to go to the shop with my mother, and I went down, ran down the steps and turned around the corner running, and Phil Byrne, who was probably only my age now, mid-50s, smoking a cigarette just at the gable, looking out, says, "That's a bad day, Phil, isn't it?" Now, this particular day was horrible. Like, there was no boats, there was northerly gales, there was big seas running. Like, and he looked at me, I'll never forget the look he gave me. He says, "That's not a bad day, lad." And I didn't know how to react, but I knew not to answer him. And something went, "Ooh, what does he mean by that?" So I went and done what I had to do. My mother came back up and asked my father, stood up. I says, "Dad," I says, "what do you think about it?" And he says, he says, "Phil's probably on the Stalwick." And I says, "What's that?"
"Well, the Stalwick was a great steamship out of the Netherlands. 280 feet from stern to bow, 2,500 tons. In a cargo transportation bound from America, her convoy sailed along the coast near Inishbofin Bay. German submarines and wild Atlantic storms, escorted by six Navy boats, they made their passage north. But on the 50 of December, struck by a hurricane, her rudder broke, she welded rifts and snapped her anchor chain.
SS Stalwick was built in Rotterdam in 1920. 2,489 tons of steel driven by a steam engine. When World War II broke out in Europe, the crew didn't return home to the Netherlands, and instead they remained at sea, moving cargo between Newfoundland and Liverpool. Between the war and the weather, the sea was extremely dangerous, both above and below the water. The Stalwick had narrowly evaded torpedo attacks twice that year, when their convoys had been hit, sending 8 ships to the bottom of the Atlantic. On this journey, the Stalwyck was part of Slow Convoy 13. Records show that on the 3rd of December, 2 German U-boats tried to locate the convoy, but they had changed their course for the northwest coast around Donegal. On the 5th of December, having been hit by a ferocious storm, the Stalwyck broke their rudder and started to drift towards rocks near Inishbofin Island. The captain radioed for help and told his crew to put on life jackets. He dropped anchor, and the chain snapped immediately.
You know, this boat had been in trouble for a couple of days, and it's only as a last resort, because on the afternoon of the 6th, a British destroyer came in to effect a rescue and try to get a tow rope aboard. They were almost lost, the destroyer. It went so far over that it took down waters down the main funnels of the boat. The captain was so badly injured, he never sailed again. That was his last sailing. He was so badly injured from taking a fall in the wheelhouse. And after this happened, the destroyer, they pulled off and says, you know, we can no longer render assistance.
Well, the following day, the Navy came to pull the Stalwyck free. 1,000-ton destroyer came a-crashing through the sea. But Her Majesty's ship, the Sabre, was swept over by a wave. They nearly drowned, turned around and sailed for Derry Cay.
Night before this all happened anyway, the lifeboat crew got a call that there was a boat in distress down at the Boffin Islands, but the weather was so bad that time that they couldn't venture out at night, that it had to be a daylight job, you know.
Did they put off maroons in that?
No, they didn't put off any maroons that morning because they were a hand-picked crew, Jerry. They didn't put off any maroons. The rockets, we call them. The way the lifeboat used to go that time, the rocket went off and everybody ran to the station to get this life jacket, you know. You got 2 or 3 pounds for it. By going out, you mightn't be going far. But nobody ran that morning because they didn't have to run. All they had to do was look out there.
I used to hate them. I can never remember them so much in the daytime, but I always remember them at nighttime. And the two very distinctive noises, one which was leaving the fire mechanism. You know, I can hear the sound yet. It was very much a psssh, almost like a firework, magnified times 30. And then it would go maybe 400 or 500 yards up into the air, and then it was like a boom. When these maroons would go off, particularly if my father was fishing, I remember my mother used to get very, very in a state of panic. And I'm sure every woman in the same situation would feel the same, because everybody would think, well, OK, it's my husband or my father's in trouble. And that was just a natural thing. And you could always tell the seriousness of the incident by the frequency and how they go off. You know, I remember the night with the Avenue Marie in 1975, and then shortly after that, when the Carrigan went down in November 76, them two stick in my mind, because it was pshh, bang, and it was six went up, so you knew it was bad.
There would be no maroons calling the crew to the station on this night. Bert was a rescue like no other. The Arranmore lifeboat was called at midnight on the 6th of December, 1940. And then, coxswain Jack Boyle had to go knocking on the doors of his chosen crew to ask them, would they go?
I can just imagine them meeting in the morning of the 7th and looking out and saying, well, Jesus, you know, what are we going to do here? Like, and I do remember an interview that was actually played that Fulburn done. He did a piece for the Girl Fact, reading the Girl Fact, and the translation of it was, you know, we'll tackle it. And I think that was, I love that term, you know. It's like, okay, we'll tackle it.
So once that crew was picked, they were picked the night before?
The night before, and they were told to come down to meet at the old station. So you can imagine what they were going through that night.
If it were I got out at sea where the stormy winds are howling, praying someone rescue me back to home and my darling.
That morning when they left anyway, they all kissed their wives and goodbye. That's how bad it was.
Tonight I'm with you on dry land, but the coxswain is calling.
Jack told him, the skipper told him, we have to go. Have to go. We have to make this rescue. There's 18 men out there crying for help, so we gotta go.
Well, I swear I am a lifeboat man, and I'm sailing in the morning.
So at 8 o'clock in the morning, they got to the station and they got aboard the boat and they started off for the Baffin Islands. And they decided they would all go up to the hill above my home, and we sat and we watched that boat till she left the moorings.
The neighbours watched them gather and they cast a worried eye and wondered how that lifeboat crew could possibly survive. They all agreed that swam at least the greatest price would pay. The old man shed a tear and knelt down on the ground to pray. While standing on the pier with his hand-picked squad of men, Jack told each man that they might never see their homes again, and told them there would be no shame if this time they said no. While each traced a cross upon his brow, stepped up and said, I'll go. I will go, I'll do the best I can, I'll do what must be done. I'll go, cause I'm a lifeboat man, I am my father's son. I will go, I'll do the best I can, I'll do what must be done. I'll go, cause I'm an island man, I am my father's son.
They launched the lifeboat, and Jack Boyle steered them straight out into the storm. Andrew, along with his father and neighbours, watched in disbelief as the lifeboat chose the route towards the Mala, a treacherous breaking point in the sea known as the Blind Rock. Here, only a few minutes from home, the lifeboat crew were nearly lost.
They headed off anyway, and I swear now, that rock out there, that the Mallow Rock, you know, that's the direction they go down. And that boat went down at the bow of it here, and she didn't come up till she was well to the other side of it. She was all underwater, you know. There was one crewman that told me the whole story. His name was Joe Rogers. He told me that he was up on the deck, clearing away ropes, and finally we shouted to go duck. I lay down on the boat, he said, and I put my two hands round the mast, and I held on. And by the time I got up, he said, I couldn't draw my breath.
Why they went down the Blaine Rock, I don't know. That part of it I never figured out. There obviously was a good reason for it, you know, maybe because the other channel inside Caffeine, as we would call it, must have been all broken, or maybe low tide or whatever. To me, that would have been the logical way to go, but obviously there was a reason why they didn't go that way. In fact, as we're talking here now, I think that the Blaine Rock was always going to be a big test either way of what was going to happen. Well, if they get down the Blaine Rock, that's a good test. And if they were going to be lost, well, at least they were going to get lost close to home.
The Stalwick had been on the rocks and breaking up now for a whole night. They had watched the Navy try and fail to rescue them. Some of their crew had gone overboard. They had lost their radio equipment, and their lifeboat had been swept away by the sea. As far as they would have known, their lifelines were all gone. They hadn't been home to the Netherlands since German occupation began. They hadn't seen their friends or family in months, and didn't know when they would see them again.
The bone. I don't think I'll make it back home. I'm so sorry I left before we were married. That I'll never be there for the cradle or baby.
Apparently my mum was pregnant then. He knew. I mean, they were writing to each other all the time, and he was obviously not just thinking about himself and his family back home in Holland, but his about-to-be family in England.
Well, this afternoon they attempted a rescue. We saw them approaching and thought it was over. We laughed and we cheered and held on to each other. Then we watched the huge wave pull a naval boat under. Well, sweetheart, I'm sorry. Well, sweetheart, I'm sorry. Well, sweetheart, I'm sorry. Well, sweetheart, I'm sorry. Shoot the line and haul them home.
The people from Moy Island witnessed it, and the school kids were all taken out of the school, and they were taken up to the high hill in Owey, and they watched her going all the way down, like, and around the head of Owey. They didn't know where they were going, but they said there was no way they were coming back.
Who would brave the deadly ocean? Shoot the line and haul them home.
The people in Lisboa couldn't believe when they looked out and they seen this small little boat coming in, and the sea smashing all around. That was the animal men. That was the lifeboat.
You heroes all come hear my song, I swear it is no lie. They watched the sabers sail away and thought their end was nigh. But through the waves a boat rose up, those men from Arranmore. Cry and fear not, brave sailors all will take it back to shore.
Picture them coming in to, you know, position themselves, and there were still 18 men on board this boat. Position themselves, you know, very trickily into a place where they can then shoot a line across Breeches Buoy, which is a line they would have shot of where there's a double line. There's a line goes out, and a line goes back where there was a cradle on it, so you can put a person into it.
Steer ill and drop the.
Had to anchor and get that in position, shoot the line, and I think on the first line they went across, I think they got as many as 10 off, but then the rope chafed on the stalwick, so it broke, which meant the lifeboat was a lost position, so they had to go out, re-anchor, come back in, start this process again. 5 hours it took.
The first shot carried 10 men with her, shoot the. Started over, shoot the light and haul them home.
They're down three cartridges, and if you can imagine, the weather were in all day, so the winter fired the third last one. It was wet, useless, didn't go anywhere. Second last one, useless. They were down to the very last cartridge. Now, if that didn't fire, there was two, including one of them being the captain.
The last shot fired over their shoulders. Shoot the line and haul them home.
The last one went right over their heads. The two remaining were so cold, they didn't actually get a chance to do the Breeches Buoy and do the cradle. It was into the water, and they pulled them across the water, the last two, because they knew that they had to get them off.
They held on tight and leapt to the water. Shoot the light and haul them home.
The captain was the last man to come aboard, you see, and Joe was pulling them in. And Chippy said, give me that out of your hand. Give me that out of rope here. Why, Joe said, that's what I can do. No, he said, fill us 3 bottles of whiskey with the meal. the captain had three bottles of whiskey, so Chippy didn't want to lose the whiskey. So when they got the man aboard anyway, the skipper seen the man with the bottle of whiskey. So he said, this is not going to work. So he took the three bottles with him and he hid them, and he wouldn't give them a drop till the land in port. See?
So I can imagine when all this was done and they had the 18 men off the boat, the crack was only starting then, because you still had to come home. What, a boat that was severely overloaded. You know, this was 18 men, you had 26 men in this boat, like a 42-foot boat, and shitty bad weather.
Jack Boyle, steer us out, take ward, keep her running. Paddy Cundy knows the sea like no other man in her. With Phil and Ailey by my side, we will plough through the weather. I swear we'll make it back tonight, or we'll all go down together.
Somebody said, are you the coxswain of the lifeboat? And he said, yes, I am. He says, I would like to tell me something about it, you know. He says, there isn't much I can tell. He says, it was just one bad day, and we done what we had to do. Got everybody off, he said. And he says, at my own door, I near lost the whole boat and the crew. It was so bad, he says, that the water was up to my chest, and I couldn't steer the wheel anymore. That's how much she was underwater. And he said, I will never know how that boat came back up again, he said. Down the field, and everybody shouting and yelling and roaring to see the lifeboat coming back, because we thought we were lost too, you see. When they got to the port, I can't tell you what happened in the port, you know. Spent 3 days out in the port. Like, I can't tell you that, you know. Yeah, it wasn't bottle muggy that they were drinking, you know.
It's hard to overemphasize just how lucky the crew of the Stalwick were to have been rescued that night. While they all dried off in the corner of the bar in Burton Port, another ship from the same convoy ran into similar trouble about 100 kilometers southwest. A 5,500-ton steamer called the SS Ashcrest broke her rudder trying to steer against the storm. And just like the Stalwick, they dropped their anchor, and the chain snapped immediately. The captain radioed for help, just as the captain of the Stalwick had done the previous night. But their call didn't reach the Navy or a lifeboat station. It was intercepted by a German U-boat. who torpedoed the Ashcrest at first light on the morning of the 8th of December, sinking the ship along with all 38 of her crew.
I often think of how they felt, you know. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, they gave up their lives, you know, to do that, you know, because they were dedicated. But now I don't think I would like to be there. I don't think I would, you know. To me, they were terrific men. And, you know, the only information that I got was from Joe Rogers, because I used to run around with Joe, and Joe told me most of all these stories now that I have for you. I fished a lot, one of them for 8-9 years, and all the time that I ever spent with him, he never talked about that night, or he never talked about that day, or he never talked about that rescue. I knew every one of them, and not one of them talked about it.
Coxswain, he called for an order.
And when they arrived out in the port, my father threw a £5 note on the counter in the pub, Johnny Gage's, and drank for the bar.
We spent the whole night in the drinking good cheer, and never a word of it after.
When they went out, there was 18 men to be rescued. Rescued them. Job done. Move along.
How many lives have I saved in my time? How many ships sail the ocean?
She says, how many lives have you saved? If I go back on my 29-year career, if you want to call it a career, and I says, I have no idea. I can tell you exactly how many I haven't.
As when I'm awake in the dead of the night, it's every life lost I remember.
Elizabeth Hayes. My father was one of the men that was rescued on the Stolwick in 1940. He was just 22. It was my mum, really, who told me that, you know, well, she said he'd been torpedoed. She wasn't even sure because my dad couldn't speak very good English at the time. He just said the boat went down. He was rescued with some of his friends, but more than that, he didn't say. My mum worked behind a bar in Garston in Liverpool, and my dad was docked in Garston always, you know, and he couldn't speak much English, but he could whistle, and he was whistling "Let Me Be Your Sweetheart" to my mum while she was working. And eventually, yes, they got together. After the rescue, my dad came home, and on the 4th of January in 1941, they were married. Apparently my mum was pregnant then, before the rescue, and yes, my sister was born in April.
The crew of the Arnmore lifeboat were awarded medals for bravery from the RNLI, and went back to their lives on the island. Coxswain Jack Boyle was awarded a gold medal, as well as a medal from Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands. But the crew rarely spoke of the rescue again.
My name is Patrick Boyle, and my grandfather was Phil Boyle, Philip Boyle. So he was on the lifeboat crew that went out to rescue the Stalwart because he was a brother of Jack.
Did he ever chat about it to you? Do you ever remember him talking about it?
Well, you know, it's iron being iron. You know, they'd not get too big ahead up there. So, no, they were humble. You know, they're humble men, and they just... Yeah, no, I don't think that they... I think they are proud of it, but they never crowed about it. Not to my recollection. And everyone I've spoken about it up there, you know, they never much spoke about it. They got the medals. That rescue that they pulled off was very, very brave. It was a very brave stunt to pull off. The kind of maneuvers that they pulled off that night were exactly what they do award medals for.
The only mention of the Stalwart since before my dad died, which was 1989, the only mention of the Stalwart after that has been through the Facebook page and Patrick Boyle and Jerry Early.
On the 7th of August, 2017, a monument to the Stalwart rescue was unveiled on the pier on Arran Moor. Hundreds gathered to watch as the monument was unveiled by Brian Byrne. His father, Naley, and Uncle Phil were members of the lifeboat crew. At Brian's request, he was also joined by Andrew Early. Liz Hayes travelled over to Arran Moor for the first time and was overwhelmed by the enormous welcome she received from the islanders. For the first time, the people of Arran Moor met the living proof of this heroic rescue. As long as there are people who can tell this story and others willing to listen, the Stalwart rescue will not be forgotten.
O'Donnell, Ward and Gallagher, remember these names well. With the Boyles, the Burns and Rogers, they faced the seas from hell. With the waves above them crashing down and a heaving mass below. God bless them, everyone who made the vow to say I'll go. Now their spirits soar above the waves, they've earned eternal rest. And surely if there's justice, they are seated with the best. And I'd like to think in that last hour, God whispered soft and low, and welcomed home the eight brave men who made the vow to go. I'll go and do the best I can, I'll do what must be done. I'll go 'cause I'm an island man, I am my father's son. I will go and do the best I can, I'll do what must be done. I'll go 'cause I'm from Arran Moor, I am my father's son. Yes, I'll go and do the best I can, I'll do what must be done. I'll go 'cause I'm an island man, I am my father's son. I will go and do the best I can, I'll do what must be done. I'll go 'cause I'm from Arran Moor, I am my father's son.
The Ballad of the Stalwart Rescue was written and presented by Brian McGlynn. The storytellers were Andrew Early, Jerry Early, Mary Gallagher, Patrick Boyle and Elizabeth Hayes. Additional interviews were by Aoife Glynn and Crona Gallagher. The song I'll Go was written by Jerry Early and John Gallagher and performed by Brian McGlynn and Jerry Early. Dá mbeidh imo bhall dóir, If I Were a Boatman, is a traditional song from Arran Moor arranged and performed by Brian McGlynn. All other music and songs were written, arranged and sung by Brian McGlynn, who also played harmonium, fiddle, banjo, mandolin, bouzouki, guitar, electric guitar and whistles. Sound mixing was by Brian McGlynn and sound supervision was by Damien Chanels. The programme was produced by Owen O'Kelly and Brian McGlynn.
You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
The Lyric Feature is available to listen to or to podcast from various well-known podcast platforms and also from the RTE radio app and, of course, The Lyric Feature's own webpage, which you'll find on the RTE website.